say good morning. I'd like to thank the organizer for giving me the opportunity to give this talk at the KITP. So I'd like to talk two subjects about the ferromagnetic semiconductors. One is about the bulk optical properties, and the other one is more focused on the individual magnets. So a little bit preamble of my talk. I mainly focus on system with ferromagnetism mediated by carriers. This is a figure I took from a Nature material paper. You see that there's a very suggestive trend of the Curie temperature with the carrier concentration. So the simplest picture for a carrier media ferromagnetism is you have the magnets have the core D levels with spin phi halves. It has one less outer electrons. And I will show you, later on, besides just counting the number of electrons, the magnet does introduce acceptor states in the gap close to the valence band edge. In fact, it's more than one state. The interesting thing about when the ferromagnetism is induced by related to the carriers, you can do interesting things like induce the ferromagnetic odor with the light. This is one early experiment that you don't see the hysteresis loop without light, and when you after you turn on the light and the system becomes ferromagnetic, you see the hysteresis loop. And the other one is, you have seen this several times now, this experiment that you can tune the ferromagnetic odor by applying electric field, and the idea is that you can gauge the carrier concentration. So we want to take an approach that start as simple as possible. So we start with just one magnet plus one hole. So talk about the theory of just single dopants. And then I want to say something about how that helps understand the optical properties for the bulk. And later on I will discuss how can you manipulate those single spins with electric field. So I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators. The most of the theoretical work is done in collaboration with Michael Flatey at the University of Iowa. The second part, some of the electric manipulation, is done in collaboration with Jeremy Levy at the University of Pittsburgh. We are collaborating with the experimenters on the scanning tunneling microscopy experiment, looking at the wave function, the acceptor state of single magnets. The STM measurement is done mainly by Andre at University of Eindhoven. The sample they used was grown by MBE and IMAC. We recently have some collaboration with Alia Stein's group on two magnets, but I only put those as a backup slide. So single magnets. So the stable configuration for when you put magnets in gallium arsenide is you substitute one of the gallium atoms. Then you have a acceptor level around 100 electron volt above your valence band edge. This is the PL measurement. So you see the transition, the electron make transition from the conduction band to your acceptor level, and you get this energy peak here. This table here just shows it's rather general for the transition metal elements in the 3-5 semiconductors. You generally get a lot of energy levels in the band gap. Okay, how do we understand this acceptor state? So if you do a simple hydrogenic model and calculate what's the energy levels, so you assume there's a 1 over R Coulomb potential. If you do that in gallium arsenide, you get the ground state energy level is somewhere around 25 megaelectron volt. For indium arsenide, it's around 16 or 17. The manganese level is around 100, so it's 4 times bigger than you get from the hydrogenic model. So then we, so what happened is that the besides the Coulomb, the Coulomb potential, the manganese D level will hybridize. It couples to the neighboring arsenic p orbitals, so it couples to the valence band state and a form anti-bonding and bonding state. So a lot of the this character is coming from the exchange interaction between the D state to the valence band state. And because of that, this state here will have the same spin character as the manganese D state. So to model that, we use a semi-classical model, so we don't really have the quantum D orbitals. So we'll put in an on-site potential at the manganese site to simulate the Coulomb effect. And then we put in the spin polarized term at the first nearest neighbor to represent the exchange coupling between the D levels and the valence band. We estimate this on-site Coulomb energy about 1 electron volt from the atomic levels. In other means, this, so there's no very definite way of doing that, but this is around the order of magnitude. And then we fit the parameter V1 to get, so that we can get the right energy level for the acceptor state. And so you get the number around 3.6 electron volt at the V, for V1. If you just consider you have a Coulomb potential, estimate the size, the Coulomb potential at the first is nearest neighbor, it's only about 0.5. So that, you can see that the exchange interaction pretty much dominates this effective potential.
What is the L index here?
Those are the orbitals.
Okay.
So no, it's the orbitals for the valence band, so it's the S and P. Okay, so to solve the single problem, we use the following method. We start with the Hamiltonian of the host for the gallium arsenide, and then put in this manganese impurity potential I just showed you. And we calculate the Green's function. So we start with the a tie binding Hamiltonian in K space, and we get the Green's function. And then we Fourier transform that into the real space. Then you, we can solve the Dyson equation for this because we basically truncated the potential, so this is a short range potential now. So we can calculate the Dyson equation and find out the full Green's function for the total Hamiltonian, and this is the formal solution. And then we can calculate various properties based on the Green's function. So as we start, this is the tie binding model for the gallium arsenide. The reason we use the tie binding instead of K dot E like calculation is because the tie binding gave more give a band structure that more appropriate to describe the full zone band structure. So that it gives you the
divides
symmetry, the crystal symmetry, and also you need the structure light to give to describe structure in real space atomic scale. So in this minimum model, you need SMP orbitals to describe the band structure. And also, if you want to include the spin orbit interaction, the minimum number of bases is 16. So you get you get a 16 band out of this with the nearest neighbor interaction and on-site spin orbit interaction.
Yes. So far you haven't added any.
No, this is for the bulk Gallium arsenide. Yes. So this is H naught, and then you calculate the G naught, and you get the local density of state for the Gallium arsenide. Now the difference between the local density of states and just the density of states is you weighted your sum of states by the wave function, so you also get the information of your wave function in real space. So for example, this is the local density of state, red is on the arsenic side and blue is on the gallium side. So they have similar shape to the density of state, but you see that you get more weight on the arsenic side when you're in the valence band. You get more weight for the, this is the last clip, but you get more weight on the gallium side when you're in the conduction band. So if you look at your wave function set near the valence band edge, you at 110 direction, that's the surface direction that people usually do the STM on, you will see a structure something like this. You see rows of arsenic atoms have stronger signal, and rows of the gallium have weaker signal. So let's see, now we put the magnets in. And then calculate, this is again the local density of states. Now you see the dashed line is the local density for the bulk gallium arsenide. So you see a very strong perturbation here in the valence band, and you get the three levels in the gap. So zero here is the top of the valence band. If you plot the spatial, so since the magnets only have one hole, these two states, the lower two levels will be occupied, the hole will occupy this highest level here. If I plot the spatial structure of this level here, this is you get at different layers. So this is the add layer where the magnets sit, and you switch away from the layers, you see. The shape changing from extended this way to extended this way. So this is the 001 direction.
So the splittings near zero, those are the acceptor levels. And the peak at minus 1 dB approximately, that's the D level?
No, the D level is further down. So these, so there's no explicit D level in the calculation.
So what are those energy resonances corresponding to? Peak at minus 1 dB,
right.
Three peaks and zero energy. What are those?
So this one is the acceptor state. So the highest one is the one with 113 electron volts. And then you, because the valence band is P-like, so you get orbital angular momentum 1. That splits your states according to the orbital angular momentum. So these are mainly the L equals plus 1, 0, minus 1.
What about the peak down at lower energies? What is that broad peak?
This is the resonance. So you basically get the full spectrum. So you can get the resonance. So it's still extended state, but it has higher probability density near the magnet. So below zero here, these are the bound states. So these are all the resonance. It's still in the band that gives you higher probability near the magnet. So even though you are not even looking, doing experimental measuring here, you can still see the resonance in, and see higher signal near the magnet in real space.
that doesn't correspond to any energy level on the manganese itself. I guess I'm just confused why it's sitting at 1 eV. I mean, what sets that energy scale? And why is
you mean, why?
That energy and not, you know, minus 2 eV?
I wouldn't really say this is one state. I mean, this is still band.
But why is the density of states peak there?
Could we see the bulk density of states again?
The bulk is the dashed line.
The bulk.
Yeah.
In the case of the Coulomb interaction, you have the continuum states that modify the band edge from square root singularity to a step. Right, and that happens in that fashion because it's a very long range potential. This is a very short range potential, so you're not going to modify. The low energy states aren't hugely influenced where they are for Coulomb potential. So instead, the bulk of the interaction is deeper now. So some interplay between the.
I mean, even you think of the Coulomb interaction. I mean, the Coulomb potential for say hydrogen atom. You can still, I mean, if you think about the continuum state, and because it's attractive potential, you have a higher probability near the, even though it's extended, but it's slightly higher probability near the impurity. So that just shows that all these energies, those states have slightly higher probability at the manganese.
Where would the D states of the manganese be if you showed those?
The D states, I think it's believed around minus 3, minus 4, that's going to go down there. So in this approximation, basically treat that's a very large number. So if you do a tunneling experiment, the spectral-wise, you see the solid line is you see on the just the gallium arsenide surface. When you move your tip on top of your manganese, in this particular experiment, we believe the condition is that. The Fermi level is above, in general, it's above the acceptor state or the state's field. But when you increase the bias, the bias between the tip and the gallium arsenide, and you can actually bend the band so that the state is moving above the Fermi level, and then at that point, then you can start tunneling into that state. So you don't see the acceptor state at the energy at 0.1 eV, but instead you see that above like 0.6 or 0.7 eV above the valence band edge. So this is the atomic resolution pictures. In principle, on the other side, you should also be imaging the field state for the manganese, but given the tunneling condition for the figure here, they are actually probing at energy at around minus 1 electron volt, so it's way down in the valence band. So you see mostly this the structure of just the Coulomb screening cloud. I'd like to say a little bit about how the shape evolves with the different layers. So again, this is a calculation that you see that the structure from extended in the 1-1 bar 0 direction to the 0-0-1 direction. And that is because we are cutting through the 110 surface. So the wave function in the zinc Brillouin lattice is basically a cubic shape or has this tetrahedral symmetry. So this is a reconstruction of the wave function in three dimension. And when you do that, you see that when you're close to the manganese layer, because of this cubic-like symmetry, you get more extended in this direction. And when you move further away from that layer and your wave function become more extended in the all one direction. So that's what you see in the calculation, and also you see the experiment, and you can see that when you the magnet is deeper down in the layer, you get weaker signal and the shape is become more elongated in the 0-0-1 direction. Okay, so that's the introduction for the single magnets. So now I'm going to talk about what can we learn from the result of the single magnets to the optical absorption. The introduction on the optical absorption for the bulk. So if you, for bulk gallium arsenide, the energy scale I'm going to talk about is about the band gap energy. So it's about this 1.5 here. So you get this turn up the band edge. This is the actually experimental data, and you get the absorption from the transition from the valence band to the conduction band. This is the our time binding calculation that we'll explain later on. You can see that qualitatively gives the same trend that you have no signal and you get more like more or less like a linear behavior for the absorption coefficient. Now, if you're trying to use a band-like model to explain the MCD data, like you explain that for two different circularly polarized light, and you say that the magnets will split has some make some spin splitting for your band edges. And in this kind of model, you expect there's no absorption, and at some point you have this turn on, you see the signal. But because the spin up and spin down bands will split in different direction, and you get the sigma minus light and sigma plus light will shift in different direction. So then you get the circular dichroism signal. However, if we believe that the N0 beta is negative and it's much bigger than the N0 alpha, you get the signal, you work out the sign and you find that it should shift this way for low doping concentration. Then it may be possible that at higher doping concentration, that when you have lots of holes and you move up your absorption edge to large K, and you can reverse that situation. But so in this application, first of all, you expect that low doping is this kind of splitting, and it should depend on the doping level. But in the experiment, you pretty much see it's always the sigma minus edge at the left, so it's the opposite to the lower concentration one. So you may say that because this experiment has very high magnet concentration. But the other thing I want to draw your attention is that you actually see the circular dichroism persists even below the band gap energy. This is another set of experiment. But instead of plotting the absolute absorption, they divided by the total absorption, so this is normalized. Again, they go down to lower magnet concentration and even lower the hole concentration by co-doped with silicon. And the message is that you pretty much always see the sigma minus edge is on the left of the sigma plus, which means the alpha minus is bigger than the alpha plus. So you get this broad positive background here. If you like the temperature dependence, then you find that you can collapse all these curves at different temperature to a single curve. That means pretty much the signal is just follow how much magnet is aligned with the magnetic field. So that means the most this possible one should be just you can just explain by the physics of just single magnets. And then you get some extra contribution that they subtracted the background out here, but I'm not going to explain that part. So I'm going to just focus on this positive peak, which the signal is pretty much just proportional to the number of magnets along with the field. So we can probably understand that from just single magnet picture. So this is what we think is going on, that now you have the magnets open in the system. Now you have a lot of disorder in the system. Then your momentum is no longer a good quantum number. So when the previous picture I showed you, that we only consider the interband transition, that because it was because the momentum conservation, that only you can only have optical transition from given from the same k state in valence band to the same k state in conduction band. But if momentum is not a good quantum number, then you can also have transition from deep in the valence band to your impurity band. And this is a schematic picture of the local density states again. And the one of the main contributions from the optical absorption is from P-like state to the S-like state. So if I plot the projection of the S-like state, so it's this blue line here, and you can see that if the valence band is mostly P-like. So you have this P-like transition from the valence band to the conduction band, and the P-like state from here to the S-like state here. But you see that, or the S-like state part here makes transition to the P-like state in the impurity band. You can see that the S-like part in the valence band, even though it's small, is still comparable to the what's in the conduction band. So as a result, you get a lot of contribution from the transition from the valence band to the impurity band for the optical absorption. So here is a slide showing you how we can do the optical absorption in tie binding model. So you get this Green's function, and you get a bunch of coefficient for the occupied state and unoccupied state. And you have to calculate the momentum matrix and making transition from one side to another side. And the momentum matrix from this side to some other side and then coming back. So you have to sum over a lot of different atomic size to get this pair correlation function. Now, so we make the first approximation for actually doing this calculation. We assume that the momentum matrix element only couples the on-site atomic orbitals.
Can you assume that the magnets are randomly?
There's only one. Yes.
Is there data for the very low, like 0.02 or something, the manganese concentration?
For MCD?
Yeah.
I have. No, I'm not aware of.
And here
you know?
Polarizing manganese, which is not, right? The single manganese doesn't polarize.
But
necessarily, they are low doping of manganese you can have right there. Up to some small percentage is soluble. Michael, are you aware of any data of that?
No. The light and see data, for example, the high temperature from gallium arsenide with the kind of 17 to 18 opening of manganese up in the SDM. That would be very nice to be able to compare and extract them.
That would be nice.
So you're looking at absorption from the valence band state into these
both
localized acceptor states.
Yes.
So not
two
impurity band like states, but just local.
So you can approximately think it's an impurity band because if you only really have just one delta function state, I think the picture would change as well, but the actual calculation, even though I say it's single impurity, but you still have a finite lifetime of your state. So there's a line width attached to the state. You have a sharp delta function. So in a sense, it's like a background impurity with one manganese.
Yeah, I guess, well, I'm not sure how important.
Although that background is not coming from actual calculation of overlap between different manganese, but there's a background which corresponding to that line with.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, the picture I have in mind is that, you know, once there's some finite density of manganese impurities, then their wave functions will start to overlap.
Right, so at this level, there's no, there's, we didn't take into account those corrections that are coming from the overlap. So it's basically assumed that the manganese is very far away with each other.
It's also supported that by the STM measurements where you can see your well-defined acceptor levels, even with a very highly doped layers. And now we see that the
how
you can, for example, see two acceptor levels that are on levels that are 8 angstroms apart, but basically just look at the superimposed and hold up with no local distortion.
I think the doping concentration is about 10 to the 18, 10 to, at delta layer, doped layer is about 10 to the 18 or 10 to the 19 per cubic centimeter.
But in highly doped manganese systems, the electron resonance parameters,
you don't see the
state, right? It's only in
SDM that you see the state. Yes, sir. What do you mean, the yes?
For the, you know, this B5, you know, those experiments, the Polish experiments, where we had with the selection rules that we can tell the D, the A.
Oh.
Yeah, but it's five.
And then what I remember, recall, maybe wrong, that in the low doping regime, very low doping, they were able to basically observe with ERS the bound impurities, and once you start doping between 1% or more, then that signal is gone. In SDM, you do see it, that one there was so much more on the surface.
Well, it's a different probe. You have a large number of different chemical environments for the manganese sensors that are putting it in a highly doped situation, and those are all going to have different G factors, and they're going to have different.
I think the boldening would be.
So, I mean, even with that weak case, it's actually a somewhat broad peak, so it's, I'm not sure that you would see it even if it were there.
But in these ERS, one more follow-up, you do see the other unbound impurity appearing, right?
Okay, so the basic message from this for this calculation is that you get a lot of contribution from the valence band transition to the impurity band, and if you consider the orbital character is reverse for the transition from the valence band to the conduction band in terms of the polarization. So so we vary the chemical potential and vary the number of lattice sites we can sum. We generally always get the sigma minus the absorption. The absorption for the sigma minus light is always bigger than the sigma plus light. So it qualitatively explains that experiment, you always see the sigma minus edges on the left. I don't want to go into the detail of the momentum matrix element unless somebody wants to ask. Summary for this part is that we are developing a theoretical tool to calculate optical processes in the presence of the impurity band. And the first result is that we can qualitatively explain that the the magnetic circuit dipoles and that why is that has such a big positive background in the signal. So that's all I'm going to say for the bulk. Now I'm going to switch to talking about this using electric field manipulation of a single magnetic spins. This work is posted on the comment here. Now, so I'm not sort of going to talk about an exact idea about quantum computing. This is the original proposal from Kim that using the nucleus spin of phosphor atom putting in the silicon matrix. And the point I want to make that is things you need to consider is that like the coupling strands between the phosphor atom. So the distance they estimate that you can actually put the gates on is somewhere around 10 nanometers of the two phosphors. So that's the length scale. And the energy scale is somewhere around the tenth of gigahertz. Now, for completion, I list the these are the actual experiments that demonstrate you can control the electron spin using electric field. But this is controlling the by spin using electric field gate the G factor. And this one is controlling the overlap between two quantum dots. But still, in both cases, there's a background magnetic field in the process. Okay, so the basic element, if you want to do a quantum computing, first you need to have a qubit, and then you need to initialize your qubit state, and you make some control, you make some manipulation to it, and then you detect your final result. So for a spin, you usually do basically like a the spin resonance measurement. And the way you do it, you apply a DC magnetic field, and you split your states. And then you apply an AC field to flip between the states. And you have to demonstrate some ability to do the two-qubit operation. So what I'm trying to think of is using this the magnetic spin in the system. Now, so let's first see whether we can have a qubit. So the simple spin model we come up with this picture is that you have this magnetic B state, you have this spin associated with the magnetic core. You have this hole state attached to the magnetic. So there's a spin-spin coupling through the exchange. And there's a spin orbital interaction between the S and L of the hole. Now the energy scale for this exchange interaction in our model is somewhere around a couple hundred milliwatts per volt for this exchange interaction. And the splitting here is about 40 milliwatts per volt for 40 milliwatts per volt between these levels. So that's the energy. So we assume that this energy is much stronger than that one. And then you look at what's the ground state of this spin Hamiltonian. So you get phi half from the manganese, and you get the anti-aligned spin from the hole, and the angular momentum is parallel to the s, the small s. So you get the total angular momentum one state. So these are the below. You have three level here. The hole is occupied this one. So the ground state of when the hole is occupying the top level here is has J equals to 1. So now in terms of thinking this is a semi-classical spin, we now consider this whole complex as a quantum object. Now so it's a so J equals 1 state. Now because J equals 1 is a irreducible representation of the tetrahedral group, so even though you put it into the lattice, this is still, you still have the three degenerate levels for this J equals 1 state. I can do a ESR measurement. This is the early measurement on for dilute manganese in gallium arsenide. So you see signal at the, this is for field. So this is without hole. So you see the just the manganese core 5½, and you get G factor 2. And you get these two extra lines coming from the J equals to 1 state. So you have one hole attached to the manganese. You have three levels, and you can make transitions between those three levels. Now, in order to do the electric manipulation, we have to look closer about on the symmetry of the wave function. So if you look at, so this is again the 3D reconstruction of the wave function. This is a corresponding atomic arrangement. So this would be the manganese, but it's corresponding to the gallium side, and that's the arsenic side, and so on and so forth. And you see, so you have this tetrahedral symmetry attached to your acceptor state, which means you break the inversion symmetry. You have several contributions in the actual, in the bulk, you, there are two reasons you break the inversion symmetry. One is because the gallium atom is different from the arsenic. And the second reason that this wave function is break the inversion symmetry is just because you put an impurity at one type of atomic site. Now, in the real experiment, you always have the surface that also breaks the inversion symmetry. Now, when you have inversion symmetry breaking, usually if you have a half integer spin, you have to split the state by applying a magnetic field. But if you have an integer spin and you don't have inversion symmetry, then you can break the splitting by either applying a strain or applying electric field. So if you apply strain, this is the effective Hamiltonian you will get. The case we're interested, if you're applying electric field, you get an effective Hamiltonian like this, which is it's first order in the electric field. If you have the inversion symmetry, then the Hamiltonian will always come in as an even order of the electric field. Now, because the electric field doesn't break the time reversal symmetry, so the angular moment power is always coming in even order. So we can calculate what's the energy scale associated with this if you apply electric field. So we have the wave function, and we can put in an electric field and calculate the splitting. So this coefficient will, if you assume there's an electric field around 40 kilo electron volt, you can translate that to a splitting, the coupling constant to about this order of magnitude, which corresponding to if you have the same spin, you apply a magnetic field around 1 tesla. We also did some estimate for the overlap between the manganese and manganese if they had around 10 nanometer separation, and the energy, interaction energy is around between 10 to 100 microelectron volts. So here is how we estimate the energy between two the manganese. So did the calculation by putting two manganese instead of just one, and you see that the original three levels will split into various six levels. And the if you look at around this direction, this side separates about 1 nanometer, and the splitting scale is around 100 electron volt. So then we calculate the just the direct overlap between two manganese. If I go from 1 nanometer to 10 nanometer here, the signal will drop by about 3 order of magnitude. So that go from 100 electron volt to 100 microelectron volt. So those energy scale corresponding to the frequency around tens of gigahertz scale. So that's about the manipulation part, and then here's the detection part. So because the previous wave function I showed you that has the exact tetrahedral symmetry is because I assume the magnetic spin is random, so I average all the directions. But if you actually consider the magnetic spin as if you put the spin degree of it, it actually has the preferred direction when the magnet is aligned certain direction. So here is a calculation that if you assume your magnetic spin is along the 0-0 direction, that's the wave function. If you turn that magnetic spin to different orientations, then you see that the wave function has some change. That because the orbital there's an orbital character attached to it, because the whole wave function is as the orbital angular moment is always parallel to the magnet. So that means spatial-wise, your wave function is more extended in the perpendicular direction. So here the calculation that if you point your spin, so this is a 110 surface. If you point your spin in the in-plane direction, so in this case the old one is this direction, this one is in the horizontal direction, and your wave function is more sticking out in the perpendicular direction. So you, when you probe it above your magnet, you get a stronger signal. And if your magnetic spin is pointing out of the plane, then you will get a weaker signal because the wave function is more localized within the sample. This is a plotting estimate between the difference if you make of the plus one, minus one state and the zero state. So there's about 90% change. Actually, there's a 90% change in contrast of the signal. So in principle, you can probe that difference to determine whether your spin direction is in plane or out of plane. So here is a setup for probing the spin resonance using our electric fields. So you have the magnet sitting here. You apply a DC field in one direction in the plane. You will also have a DC field between your STM tip and your samples. And then you apply a transverse AC electric field to manipulate your different spin state. So if you look at the energy diagram, that the J equals to one state, when you apply the DC field, will split into three levels. And the bias voltage can change where this energy level relative to the valence band edge. So you can put two of your levels below the Fermi level, and then you initialize your state in the lowest energy configuration, and you can move them up into the gap, and then you apply the AC field to make transition between these levels. And eventually, if you go to higher bias, then get the tunnel condition, and then you can probe what's your final state. There is a little bit complication when I show the previous graph on the detection and the electric configuration, because the previous graph for detection, I actually show you the state using the JZ eigenstate. But if you actually using the electric field to split your three states, you are not working with the JZ eigenstate. Instead of you working with the zero state of the JX, JY, JZ state. So that's labeled as the XYZ state. I took a particular configuration here, so I assume that the DC field is on this plane here, spanned by 001 and 110 direction. This particular case, that when you do that, you only couple two of the states. So parameterize everything in terms of this angle theta here. You get the level splitting in most directions, except for these crossing points. And these are the corresponding eigenstates spanning that So you got mentioned that J equals one space. That angle is plotting as the back curve here. And then you get the AC field applied to it, and you get the coupling between the red and blue states. So in this particular configuration, the coupling between to the green states is always zero. So you can sort of consider this, even though you have three states, this is like a pseudo two-state system. And then you can calculate when your the projection of your final state as a function of this parameter here. So you see that in one case like close to here, you will be probing one direction that either the red state is pointing out to your detection, so you get bigger signal in one state and small, and the other, because the other state is perpendicular, you get a much smaller signal. So this contrast here is it's similar, it's about 90% similar to when you use the JZ state eigenstate to do the calculation. But there's a subtle difference. Okay, so to summarize this part, there's an isotropic shape of the Magnus acceptor state wave function dominated by the cubic symmetry of the lattice. But it's the cubic symmetry is further lowered by the dopant substitution, the spin orbit induction, and the Volkan-Ball conversion symmetry. So because of this, you can use electric field to replace all the magnetic field to do the spin resonance experiment. So thank you for your attention. Actually, difference in calculation. We haven't really.
You show the optical.
Right. So we haven't done the calculation for the infrared yet. But what we expect, there will also be a signal.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, coming from the.
Can I ask just a technical question on the tight binding?
Mm-hmm.
Tight binding fits very notoriously non-unique. Usually you choose a localized orbital basis, and then you have a large overlap matrix, so you choose one of your functions, and then you have very long range. So you have orthogonal orbitals, and you have very long range interactions.
No, usually you...
Did you make your choice?
No, this earlier model that you... Basic truncate all those. So you only use the first nearest neighbor hopping matrix.
And then you have an overlap.
So there's only overlap between two nearest neighbors.
It's an orthogonal basis.
No, I think in this one it's orthogonal. But I mean, you have different choices, yeah.
Sensitively, do the results depend on these choices? On fitting them?
No, we didn't do the fitting part. I mean, basically, that's for the bulk Galling arsenide. So we just took that from the old literature. So we're basically looking at the difference between when you put, after you put manganese in and without manganese. So the most reliable part for the calculation is looking at the difference with and without manganese. So we don't care that much about how good the fitting to the bulk. But it did pretty decent job for the valence band. The conduction band, the effective mass is off by a factor of 2, I think. But I think if you do a, even if you do a K-DOP, you have different issues with the fitting parameters.